Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. According to 2003 statistics, as many as 43% of adults across this country lack basic literacy skills needed for entry-level jobs. In a time when it is said by almost all the experts that one needs at least a bachelor's degree in order to make a decent living in this country, how are these adults falling through the cracks in our education system? One means of addressing this is the PhD in literacy studies that is being offered here at MTSU, and Dr. Diane Sawyer is here to talk about that with us today and the education of people who could perhaps stem the tide of illiteracy in America. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Gina. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to speak with you and your audience.
That one statistic is shocking enough in and of itself, but how much deeper does this literacy crisis go than we here in this industrialized nation of you know, great capitalistic wealth even begin to understand?
Well, let me give you a statistic that comes right from our own Rutherford County. In 2006, there was a community-wide needs assessment, and this was sponsored by the United Way, MTSU, and Leadership Rutherford. They found, and this is this statistic is shocking, 44% of the adults in Rutherford County did not read beyond the third grade level. Now, we think about Rutherford County as being the seat of a major educational institution, as having excellent schools and a high demand for people in technology and in manufacturing and in service industry. And yet, nearly 50% of the workforce does not have the basic skills that are necessary to perform the jobs that we have available here.
So the answer to why can't Johnny read might have at least as much to do with why Johnny's daddy can't read as it does with anything going on in K through 12, right?
Well, I think that's an interesting point, and we often look at the statistics for literacy in relation to issues associated with employment, clearly, and then that in relation to poverty. And we know, for example, that in Tennessee, and I'm taking these statistics from the Department of Human Services, that 24% of the children 0 to 5 receive assistance through WIC. Now, that's the Women and Infants and Children Support Services. 10% of that population dropped out of school. 10% of the families.
Do we know at what stage of school they dropped out?
Well, this is interesting. If we look at the dropout rate for the 2006 cohort in Tennessee, 9% of the students in that cohort dropped out of school. And there are some other interesting statistics that I think really help us to put this into a different light. If we look at the number of children who are served in the free and reduced lunch, 39% of school-aged children are provided a meal in school, and often it's a free breakfast as well as a free lunch. Now, clearly that's based on family income. And the family income is obviously reduced when we have a situation where people cannot get even entry-level jobs. These are people who are perhaps taking part-time jobs or the kinds of jobs that one takes because you hope you can do the job, but then you, in fact, lose that job.
When one's cannot even read at the third grade level, the kind of job available to that person, the adult, is going to be flipping burgers at McDonald's, tarring the road, things that are involve manual labor and common sense, but not necessarily an advanced ability to think critically, or certainly not what people commonly refer to as book smarts.
Well, I think if we look at those students who drop out of school and we consider that very issue that you raised, the opportunities for employment, 17% of youth 18 to 25 are unemployed. This is also contributing then to what we might consider behavior that is not consistent with what we would hope would occur in our society.
Now, just so people don't get confused, because we are in very difficult economic times right now, the statistics you cite, which are the most recent statistics available, don't really have anything to do with the current economic crisis.
That's correct. These statistics are from Kids Count. This is a Tennessee database, and they are from 2006. So we were in pretty good economic times in 2006, and still 17% of our youth, 18 to 25, were unemployed. If we look at the Department of Economic and Community Development again here in Tennessee, and the most recent statistics I could get there were 2000. And again, our labor force in 2000 was the opportunities for our labor force were fairly strong. What we have here is about 25% of those who were 25 years and older had less than 12 years of schooling. 10% had less than ninth grade education. So if we're looking at the opportunities for employment, even in good economic times, they're pretty reduced. The special census that we had here in the state of Tennessee in 2003, and these statistics come from the U.S. Census Bureau, they reported that barely one-third of Tennesseans possessed a high school diploma. Now, if we try to equate what that means in terms of employability, if you have less than 9 years of schooling, and these are national statistics, 2006, only 22% were employed nationally. If you had at least 9 years of schooling, 13% were employed. But even if you had 11 or 12 years of schooling but did not have a diploma or a GED, only 44% were employed. So we're looking again at more than 50% of our population having the consequence of low opportunities for employment because they have low literacy skills.
This is a message that has been driven home to people through public service announcements, through news stories and news interviews on radio and television and in the newspapers and on the internet all my life. Why aren't some people getting the message?
I think we have to look at what has been done and then what has not been done. If we look at what has been done at the federal and state level, since 1971, there has been a 90% increase in per pupil spending, specifically to support the enhancement of reading and math skills in our K-12 population in this country. And yet, we're finding, as you said at the beginning, that 43% of our population, of our adult population, is not functionally literate. What we have found, I think, is that in our schools, we are not providing effective educational opportunities. And by that I mean at least 40% of the population in our schools is not benefiting from the instruction in literacy that is being provided. There was a study done in 2006 by a nonprofit organization, the National Council on Teacher Quality. And their finding was that 85% of the schools of education were not providing the principles of good reading instruction. That is, the faculty, by and large, were following conventional wisdom, but were not integrating the knowledge that we have gained through scientific research over at least the last 20 years. The teaching ideas that are being provided even today are not supported by years of scientific research. Now, this has led through federal legislation to the mandate that states provide opportunities for professional development for their teachers, and also the demand that new teachers be hired who are, quote, highly qualified, unquote. This is a term that is being used specifically in legislation related to No Child Left Behind, and within that legislation and the reauthorization for the Individuals with Disabilities Act. But within the legislation, there is the concern that the quality of instruction being provided would be enhanced if we had highly qualified teachers.
Now, what does that term, vis-a-vis the law that you mentioned, highly qualified, mean? Is it subjective, or is it? Do you have to meet very specific criteria to be considered highly qualified?
Primarily, it is a consequence of having met the standards for the education provided in our schools of education for obtaining a license. And then that also includes, to be licensed, there is a mandate that you pass a test. And the test has various components, including a component on literacy. Now, unfortunately, what we have seen over the last several years is that the questions on these tests do not adequately tap the kinds of concepts and knowledge that would be necessary to provide a change in the way in which we are actually educating our children. So we are testing teachers on what they have learned, but we are not necessarily testing them on what they must know in order to be more effective in the classroom. There is one example in the state of Connecticut where the State Department of Education actually redesigned their test. This test is called the Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, Praxis test. They redesigned that test to be consistent with their expectations for highly qualified. And there is a movement in this country now to have more states comply with that concept of testing teachers on what they need to know to be effective rather than what they have learned in their classrooms.
That means that we're talking about very pragmatic techniques and methodologies and not just education theory, although they're going to get a heaping helping of that at the college level as well.
I think more importantly, what the study from the National Council on Teacher Quality has discovered, and also other studies on teacher education in this country since 2005, 2006, 2007, what they're discovering is that we need to change what is happening in the classrooms in our teacher education programs by introducing and infusing the knowledge that has been obtained through research over these last many years. And the new PhD in literacy studies at MTSU is, in fact, organized around a core set of courses that will bring together the concepts of biological, language, and cultural characteristics of children K-12, and teach our candidates for this degree to apply this knowledge for effective instructional practices. And this will be done through field experiences and through practicum experiences. So not only will what they are learning be changed dramatically from what is common across this country in teacher education programs, but there will also be a very close watch on their ability to take the information and to apply it in more meaningful ways.
How unique is this program by comparison to what is being done in other colleges and universities across the country? Is it one of a kind? Is it one of a handful?
To the best of my knowledge, there is a movement across the country to begin to incorporate more of this kind of approach to teacher education. But we have a unique advantage here at MTSU in that we are starting from scratch a brand new approach to the PhD program that will prepare not only teachers in colleges and universities who will be in teacher preparation, but also those who will be working in the K-12 setting. Most colleges and universities in this country who already have programs designed for teacher preparation will find it much more difficult to bring about the kind of change that we are able to initiate through the inauguration of a whole new program.
This program, the PhD in Literacy Studies program, also involves a curricula supported by both the College of Education and Behavioral Science, which is the college at MTSU where fledgling teachers or people who aspire to be teachers couch their major, and the College of Liberal Arts. Now, what is the advantage to this interdisciplinary approach?
The advantage is that we have specialists in their own areas working with people who are learning to be teacher trainers and people who will be focusing on bringing about more effective instruction in school settings. And so, for example, out of the College of Education and Behavioral Science, we have Dr. Manya, who is our neuroscientist. And he offers two courses that help our students to better understand the nature of the biological foundation of learning. The neuroscience, neurobiology of language and literacy is the first course, and the cognitive neuroscience of language and literacy will be his second course. And so what he is doing is bringing his field of expertise to the study of language and literacy, which are the core requirements if we're going to understand the issues of how spoken language and written language relate. In the College of Liberal Arts, we have the Department of Linguistics offering courses to our students who help them to understand language in a cultural context. We know that we have a very diverse population in our K-12 programs, and we need to understand the language and the culture that a child brings to the classroom. That will impact what we need to understand about how to reach that child in the instructional environment.
And we're talking here, at least in part, about the large influx of Hispanic students in recent years, right?
Well, it's not just Hispanic. We have a huge population of many different languages and cultures. Just for example, in Metro Nashville, as I understand it, there are about 55 or 58 different languages representing different cultures in those schools.
Yeah, here in Murfreesboro, a thriving Laotian community.
Absolutely. And so what we have also in the College of Liberal Arts is the Communication Disorders Program. And faculty there will be bringing to our teachers, our candidates for teacher education as well as work in the schools, a better understanding of language acquisition. We know that, for example, my area of specialization is dyslexia. It often is called the hidden disability because it appears that the child is has average intelligence or better, seems to come from an environment where the family really cares about the child's learning and so forth. But what the child has great difficulty with is learning to read. And we find when we scratch the surface that there is also an undiagnosed language problem at the core of the reading problem.
It seems to me, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the K-12 teacher, in attempting to discern which of the kids in her classroom might have a dyslexia problem, it's rather like the general practitioner in the medical field being told that he has to be more aware of his patients possibly having depression and possibly needing to be referred to a specialist in order to treat that depression. Now, I'm not comparing dyslexia to depression in terms of, you know, depression is a mental illness, dyslexia is a learning disability, but there seems to be the need for a generalist to be able to pick out certain characteristics, if you will, and have that alarm go off in the head and say, this is a possibility and I need to explore the possibility this child might be dyslexic. And so they have to know certain signs.
That's absolutely true, Gina. But I think we have to think about this teacher like the general practitioner who is seeing 24 children at a time and being aware of the various characteristics that both support and might inhibit the child's learning in that particular environmental setting. And so what we have to do is prepare teachers to be aware of the learning process specific to literacy, in our case, and to be recognizing every child's advantages and potential disadvantages to responding to the instruction that is provided. And that is the basic component of our core investment in this program, that teachers are not going to be prepared to just, for example, understand how particular methods or approaches to instruction work and how to apply them. But rather, we're looking to have people who are in their own way observational scientists who are going to look very closely at every child as a learner, not as a deposit, not a place in which we deposit information, but rather a child, every individual, that must connect with what it is the teacher hopes to accomplish. And it is the teacher's responsibility to understand what it is about that child, what characteristics permit that connecting, and what characteristics might perhaps be those which inhibit connecting.
It seems to me that just as a layperson look outside the classroom, looking into the classroom, and this may be a problem that has manifested itself in many prior generations before the current one in various ways, the pressure, the peer pressure that says to a child, learning isn't hip. You're not cool if you make good grades. You're not cool if you read well. You're not cool if you do anything that pleases the teacher, who is that authority figure in the classroom. With regard to all kinds of kids, in some instances, sometimes in urban schools, African-American kids are made to feel that if they read well, then they are quote-unquote white, that they are Oreos, black on the outside, white on the inside. And how much of a role does this peer pressure, this need, this feeling on the child's part to dumb himself or herself down in order to gain acceptance from his contemporaries play into this literacy problem?
I think, Gina, that there is no way that we can generalize that all children who act out or all children who, particularly we'll say the middle school children, children ages 11 to 17, 18, middle school and high school, that their sole goal in life is to be hip. One of the things that I'd like to call your attention to and in our listeners is the front page of the local section of the Daily News Journal on Monday, the 6th of October. There was a wonderful story about a young man who is attending a program that is providing him with the kind of literacy instruction that he needed. He was one of the kind, it was a kind of child that you have just described. He didn't really care about what was going on in school. He really didn't care about school. He was not, we say, motivated. And might well have been the child who was looking for peer group approval. He reports that after having been 2 years in this special program that is provided through the auspices of the juvenile justice system, he now has a focus. He now has a better sense of self. And not coincidentally, he has learned to read and to appreciate what he can learn through reading. I think we have to scratch the surface of every child who is acting out. There are many reasons for this, but one of the things that I think we forget, here's a citation from the Department of Corrections, and this is January through June of 2008. That's this year. 58% of those who were in the juvenile detention system fell into the age group 11 to 18. 15% of those noted that the last grade they had completed was 7 through 11. All right, they were dropping out. And if we look further at this, we see that the children who are dropping out, not in every instance, but in many instances, are those who feel that they simply cannot be successful. And they take on an aura of bravado to cover the fact that they're not successful. No one wants to be to persist in something that you find difficult, if not impossible. And if you don't feel that the adults around you are making their best effort to help you to accomplish those things that are so critical to your future, then why would you not stop trying?
You've outlined an incredible need, and you've outlined what this PhD in literacy studies can do to prepare people to address that need. Now, what sorts of job opportunities does this PhD prepare the students who strive for it for, besides K through 12 teachers?
We have four tracks, really, where, and I should use the term specializations. People coming into the program will all have accomplished a master's degree. They will all have at least 3 years of successful experience in the school setting. We accept people who might have been classroom teachers, reading teachers, special education teachers, school psychologists, or administrators.
So this is a field ripe for non-traditional students.
What we then are dealing with is, and actually I forgot, also speech-language professionals in the school setting. We also then are preparing those who are interested in doing this to become professionals who provide teacher training either as part of an education, a college of education program where they are part of an undergraduate or graduate degree program, or there's an area that is growing in this country, and very much so here in Tennessee, and that is a professional development specialist. These are people either employed, self-employed, or employed in the school system, or employed by the state, to go into the schools and provide professional development opportunities for teachers. We also are providing a track for those who wish to go into school administration. After all, our school leaders are administrators, and they need to be better informed about what literacy is and how to provide effective instruction. We also are providing a track for those who might be interested in publishing, and as well as research, people who might go into the preparation of test materials or instructional program materials, taking their experience not only in the school setting, but also in our program.
With so little time left, I have to ask you what sorts of opportunities are available for someone who might want to make their career as someone who teaches adults who are illiterate or semi-literate, who deals directly with the adult learner, and are the people who take those jobs likely to deal with classrooms full of people, classrooms of small handfuls of students, or would they more likely to deal with the semi-literate adult one-on-one?
All of those kinds of programs, in fact, exist. One-on-one tends to be primarily the volunteer program, where you or I or one of our neighbors might feel a commitment to help one particular individual or that is known to them, or someone that they get from a volunteer program such as Read to Succeed here in Murfreesboro. And they share what they know with very limited preparation on the part of the sponsoring organization. There is also, and I was pleased to see that here in Rutherford County, funding has again been made available for the adult education program that is run by the county. I was surprised to see that it had been suspended due to funding. Here we tend to have small classes, and the people who are providing that instruction tend to be licensed teachers, teachers who may have retired or teachers who are currently employed by the county and who have had either training at any level, elementary, middle, or secondary. They, in all likelihood, have not had specific preparation in the teaching of reading unless they are elementary classroom teachers. They, however, probably have had specific opportunities to learn how to work with the adult population. And large classes typically do not exist unless they are part of ESL programs. And we have many adults who are literate in their own language and who are coming to this country with the hope for either opportunities for education or opportunities for employment. And larger class sizes for those individuals where they're really making the transition to the spoken language and the written language in a new culture.
Now, if people want to know more about this PhD in literacy studies, which could help put people in the pipeline, so to speak, to help deal with this crisis in American education, who do they contact and how do they contact them?
I'm happy to say that we have a dedicated website where people can get basic information about the program. That is www.mtsu.edu/literacy. Actually, there's a tilde in there somewhere.
Yeah, the forward slash, then the tilde, then literacy.
That's right.
Right.
And if they have specific questions about their own eligibility, after they have looked at that, they're welcome to call me. And my phone number is 615-494-8840. But I really would prefer an email, dsawyer@mtsu.edu.
And no, she is not related to the lady on Good Morning America who happens to be married to Mike Nichols.
But I had that name first.
She'll be happy you said that. Thank you, Dr. Sawyer. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate this opportunity.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at this same time next Sunday. Also, you can check out the podcast at mtsunews.com at your leisure, and we're available on iTunes as well.